It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says a new black surrealism is showing up in movies and TV shows that use satire and absurdity to raise questions about race in the United States. First, a $100 million tax incentive package aimed at keeping two Kimberly-Clark factories in Wisconsin faces an uphill battle in the state Senate. Kimberly-Clark announced earlier this year that it would close two plants in Neenah and Fox Crossing. That would result in the loss of about 600 jobs in the area. Governor Walker called on the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation and lawmakers to find a way to keep at least some of those jobs in the state. While the package was passed in the state assembly in February, state senators on both sides of the aisle have raised misgivings about the package. Patrick Marley is the state government and politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, Patrick, tell us about how this incentives package is laid out. Give us the scope of it.
It's very much like the Foxconn deal. In fact, it's modeled on that. So they give a percentage of wages back to the employer. The difference, of course, is one, Foxconn would employ a lot more people than Kimberly-Clark does at these facilities. And Foxconn would be creating new jobs. This would be a deal for retaining the jobs. But provided they retained the jobs, the state would pay 17% of those wages for, I believe, 15 years. And so the some of the hesitancy among lawmakers is that the idea behind Foxconn, which of course is the large Taiwanese company that's building a plant in southeastern Wisconsin, was that that was something predicated on the idea that it would transform the state's economy, that it would bring in all kinds of new jobs in a whole new sector, and that a higher level of subsidies was warranted for something like that compared to the kinds of businesses we already have. This is applying that same size package to Kimberly-Clark, and there's some concern among lawmakers from both parties that it might be too much for a well-established industry.
What kind of price tag are we talking about here from the state?
When it passed the assembly, the estimate was that it would be more than $100 million. Now, you know, we don't know precisely what's going to happen here if this were to advance, because it is tied to how many jobs are created or retained. And so if Kimberly-Clark kept some but not all of the jobs, they wouldn't get as much money. But the upper end of it is a more than $100 million deal over 15 years.
Now, put that up against Foxconn when we're hearing numbers like $3 billion plus local incentives. $100 million may not sound that big, but taking Foxconn out, it's a big deal, right?
Well, absolutely. It's a large sum of money, no matter how you slice it. And it's about 600 jobs at the two paper-making plants and more than 10,000 at the Foxconn plant, if you're talking the full $4 billion. So, yes, the Foxconn deal costs a lot more, but it's the same price per job at both operations.
Now, give us a little of the history of the bill. It passed the assembly back in February, is that right?
That's right. In January, Kimberly-Clark announced that it was shedding about 5,000 jobs worldwide, and that as part of that, its plans, it was going to close these two operations in the Fox Valley. In response to that, the Assembly passed this $100 million deal. The Senate at the time said they were going to wait to see how things played out, because at that time, Kimberly-Clark wasn't saying whether it even wanted this deal. Kimberly-Clark was engaged in negotiations with the labor union at its Fox Crossing plant, and so the senators said they were going to hold off to see what happened. Well, this week, the union at Fox Crossing ratified a contract that has some kind of concessions. We don't know the full details of that. And now Kimberly-Clark is saying it's ready to engage in negotiations with the state over an incentive package. Now, because we don't know all of the terms of the labor deal, we don't know quite how this would work. But if the quickest way to a deal would be for the Senate to pass the same thing the Assembly has already passed, it would then go to the governor, he would sign it, and they would enter into final talks with Kimberly-Clark. The big issue here right now is that it's incredibly unclear if they could put together the votes to pass it in the state Senate.
Talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about this proposed incentive package to Kimberly-Clark, trying to get them to keep a bunch of their jobs here in the state. Patrick, the Senate and the Assembly, for that matter, I guess, neither of them's in session right now, right?
That's correct. They ended their session in the spring, so they would need to come back in either special session or extraordinary session, it's called. Basically, they bring themselves back into session to vote on it.
And what have we heard? Have any senators committed themselves one way or the other on this idea?
There's only two of the 33 senators, there's only two that I know of that have committed. The Senate President, Roger Roth, is from Appleton, so right in that area. He is strongly for it. He was pushing for it back in the spring. He sees this as a new chance to get this deal done that he wants to get done. And then Senator Chris Kabanga from Delafield is another Republican. He has issued a statement yesterday that he's very strongly against it. Everybody else is pretty quiet, saying they need to review the terms of the deal, even though it's been out there for months. But it's noteworthy. I mean, you should pay attention to where Chris Kabanga has fallen on this, because he is part of the most conservative wing of the state Senate, and there are a number of other senators who tend to vote with him on things like this. Democrats are also skeptical of this deal. Republicans have an 18-15 majority. You've got Kabanga off the bill. If all the Democrats are off of it, then Republicans could only lose one more vote to get it passed.
And this is an election year for half the Senate, and one of the Republican senators is running for U.S. Senate. Do you get a sense that people are kind of looking over their shoulder at Election Day and what their vote either way could mean?
Absolutely, because this really has regional ramifications, right? If you just look at Roger Roth, he's right there in the area. Saving jobs for him is going to be really good politics. But somebody on the other side of the state, it's not such good politics, particularly, you know, Howard Markline is a good guy to look at. We haven't heard one way or the other where what he's thinking, but he's from southwestern Wisconsin. Their voters may be skeptical of the Foxconn deal. We've seen from polling there's a lot of concern that people don't think that that deal will affect their area if they're outside of southeastern Wisconsin. Then if there's another large public subsidy for another company outside of their district, that might not go over well. So the politics may end up falling as much on regional lines as on partisan lines.
And this is the Senate, and as you mentioned, the fast road here would be to pass exactly what the Assembly passed back in February. If they make any changes at all, right, the Assembly would have to come back, too, to agree with them on that.
That's correct.
Yeah. And then Governor Walker, of course, would have to sign off on anything. What has he had to say about this incentive package?
So he's been in favor of the Kimberly-Clark deal going back to the spring. He issued a statement this week that he would like to see this done, so he is hoping that this can happen. But it's unclear how he can get his fellow Republicans who control the legislature to go along with him. I wouldn't rule that out, but it does look like an uphill battle at the moment.
I don't want to get too procedural with you here, Patrick, but who would have to call this extraordinary session, and when are they thinking of making a decision on whether or not to do that?
It would just be the Senate Organization Committee, which is a group of Republican leaders. Republicans control that committee. So if they want to come back, it's pretty easy to pull the trigger and bring them in. The Republican senators are caucusing on it next week. So I think we won't hear anything about whether they're going to try to do it or not until then. That will be really their first chance to do some nose counting and get a sense of how strongly everybody feels and whether they've got the votes.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Patrick, have people been concerned that, okay, if they do this deal, what company is next to ask for a deal?
Yes, some conservatives have been raising that very concern. They say, and some of them didn't like the Foxconn deal to begin with, but what they say is, well, there's one argument for Foxconn, and that is that you can offer a very large public subsidy because it is creating so many jobs in a new field, but that we as a state couldn't afford to give this to other businesses. If you start handing out packages that are the same relative size, everyone's going to be expecting that, and it will get very expensive for the state.
We'll leave it there. Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Marley is a state government and politics reporter at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He joined us today to talk about the tax incentives package for Kimberly-Clark, which faces an uphill battle, as we just heard, in the state Senate. Now, a film came out last year that created a lot of buzz and was nominated for a Best Picture Oscar. It was called Get Out. The story followed a young black man visiting the countryside estate of his white girlfriend's parents and the bizarre and horrifying events that followed. The film used satire, horror, and surrealistic elements to portray the young man's terrifying experience during the visit. Our next guest says Get Out is part of a trend in pop culture of surrealism and absurdity being used to portray the realities facing black people in the United States. Maya Phillips is a freelance arts and entertainment writer who's written for the New York Times, Vulture, and Slate. She wrote an article on Slate.com about an art form she's calling the new black surrealism. I talked to her earlier this week. Can you start us out by defining this phrase you use in the piece we're talking about, new black surrealism?
Sure. So I'm kind of doing a new take on something that's already been around. Mm-hmm. So that's Afro-surrealism. And, you know, poet, playwright, activist Amir Baraka, he first used that term back in 1974 to talk about the writing of Henri Dumas. And in 2009, this writer, D. Scott Miller, he came up with a more comprehensive definition. And he wrote a whole Afro-surreal manifesto that you can find it online. So in my own definition, based on what I've been seeing lately in the media, I'd say that it's artwork that uses strange elements, surreal elements, to, and whether that's in the plotting, in the characters, in the dialogue, visual aesthetic, tone, any of that, to create a true picture of Black American life. So it's real, but it's also dreamlike. Totally recognizable from what we see in the real world, but also totally dissimilar in some respects.
The idea is there are absurdities in the way we deal with race in America and in the reality of being black in America that it's more true to have these fantastical elements to describe them than just a real realistic thing. Am I getting that right?
Yes. I'm not necessarily sure if I would say it's more true, but I would definitely say it's an alternative way of illustrating that truth.
Can you talk about some of the movies and TV shows that are using some of these elements?
So I definitely would mention the TV series Atlanta. I think that's a fantastic example of it. I mean, it's a fantastic show overall, but it just has a general surrealist feel to it. That is definitely, you know, it's heavily features black actors. You know, it's written by black writers and creator Donald Glover, he's black, and it's just about black life in Atlanta. And, you know, people have talked about it as being kind of horror, kind of just very obscure, but that's part of that's Afro-surrealism, the new black surrealism, as I define it.
I'm sorry, who is this dude?
Darius,
no,
man.
That's fine, we're talking
there,
right here.
When you first walked in, I gave you a cookie.
No, yeah, I remember who you are. Look, I'm not asking for money.
You should be. Ain't you homeless?
Not real homeless. Not using a rat as a phone or something.
Don't be racist, man. Like, that make you schizophrenic. That don't make you homeless.
Wait, not if it worked, man. Nah, if you could use a rat as a phone, man, that'd be genius. I mean, it's like 5 rats for every 1 person in New York alone. Everybody would have an affordable phone. Yeah, man, I mean, it'd be messy, but worth it.
Let's stay with Atlanta for a second. Can you give us an example of how, like, surreal elements happen on the screen as we're watching?
Well, I think the example that a lot of people were talking about when it aired was the Teddy Perkins episode. You know, we have Donald Glover in this really bizarre character. He's nightmarish, really, in whiteface.
Most people wouldn't understand. To make an omelet, you have to break a few eggs. I mean, to build bridges, people have to fall.
Are you not mad at your dad?
Of course not. There was no way for a child to understand what's at stake. He just wanted the best for us. My father used to say, great things come from great pain.
It's those moments of just kind of strangeness, that it's kind of like a dream and it might be a little bit horrific, but we're still in the real world.
And another one that's getting a lot of attention right now is this movie that's just come out, Sorry to Bother You. And it's clear from the trailer there's something surreal going on. I haven't seen this one yet, so don't spoil it for me too much. I gather there are big twists toward the end. But give us a sense of how this new black surrealism plays out in Sorry to Bother You.
Yeah, there definitely is a huge twist. I definitely won't spoil that for you. You can just be that for yourself. But yeah, to sum it up, there's this telemarketer, Cassius Green, and he discovers his quote-unquote white voice. which is just David Cross's voice dubbed over his. And he suddenly becomes super successful, and he decides to make some morally compromising choices to maintain his success.
Hey, young blood, let me give you a tip. Use your white voice.
Man, I ain't got no white voice.
Oh, come on, you know what I mean. You have a white voice in there, you can use it. You want to make some money here? Then read the script with a white voice.
When people say I talk with a white voice anyway, so why ain't it helping me out?
Well, you don't talk white enough. I'm not talking about Will Smith white. I'm talking about the real deal. Like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regalview. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
So there's definitely a lot of criticism in there about race, racial performance, and capitalism, but surreal elements of it are in the characters' interactions, in the filming, which is it's very loud and cartoonish, and of course certainly in the plot, which spins out in a very crazy direction once we get to the halfway point of the movie, which is the big twist I won't spoil, but it becomes very clear that, you know, we have kind of distanced ourselves from reality at that point.
Talking to Maya Phillips, freelance arts and entertainment writer, talking about a piece she wrote on Slate.com about a surrealism, new black surrealism. She calls it absurdity as a way to talk about race in America. And Maya, another movie you point to as an example that got a lot of attention, this one I have seen, but still we probably shouldn't spoil it too much for people who haven't, Get Out. Can you talk about that one a little?
So, yeah, Get Out. You know, the whole premise is, I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, but, you know, basically white people can take over the bodies of black people. And that idea, just like, for example, the scene of the auction, that's a great surrealist scene because that is very much based in reality. It's based in the history of slave auctions. But to see that scene enacted in a contemporary world, you know, obviously a fictional contemporary world, but a fictional contemporary world that looks very much like, you know, the real contemporary world, to see that and to see these white people commodify a body and to use stereotypes to figure out what its value is just, I mean, that's the surrealist element, but it's not too far off from what we know historically and, you know, what we know culturally, what happens in the interactions, racist interactions between groups.
It's such a privilege to be able to experience another person's culture. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're going to love this. My dad's claim to fame was beat by Jesse Owens in the qualifying round for the Berlin Olympics in 1936. Those are the ones where...
Owens won in front of Hitler.
Yeah, what a moment. I mean, Hitler's up there with all his perfect Aryan race bullshit. This black dude comes along, proves him wrong in front of the entire world. Amazing.
Tough break for your dad, though.
Yeah. He almost got over it. That's the basement. We had to seal it up. Some black mold down there.
Why now? Why are we seeing these examples of surrealism in these fairly prominent movies and TV shows?
Well, if you think of all the black deaths we've seen in the past few years, I mean, like, every day, the stories of police brutality, the Black Lives Matter movement, the stories that seem to pop up every day now about white people calling 911 on black people for no real reason, it seems obvious that this would be a new trend. You know, that's Donald Glover said that. That's the reason why he wanted to tackle the absurd in Atlanta. Because of the reality of a TV celebrity being in the White House, and even Boots Riley, the director of Sorry to Bother You, has said that all these things are happening in the world, forces pushing people to make other choices, and art in the industry around it tries to respond to that, and that's exactly what we're seeing.
This is happening now, but in your piece, you point toward a longer heritage of black surrealism, Ralph Ellison and The Invisible Man being one example. These things have come up before in our art and literature.
Absolutely. I do think that there is a long tradition of that. When I talk about the new black surrealism, I describe it as more of a newer trend in TV and movies in particular, just because those are genres in which blackness in general has been a subject that has been mined less frequently because, you know, until recently, it seems like there is a sustaining belief that there weren't the black audiences for those mediums and that they wouldn't be profitable. course, like things like Black Panther has totally blown that idea out of the water. So I do think with every critically and commercially successful Black TV show or film, that broadens the field and allows for different kinds of representations of Blackness. But all that being said, I think that Black surrealism was born within the genre of literature. As I said, Mary Brock used the term. You mentioned Ralph Ellison, and people mentioned Toni Morrison in that group as well. So, you know, there is a tradition of this, and I'm personally glad that we're seeing it more in movies and TV right now.
And you mentioned Black Panther, and you also write that as we see this new Black surrealism happening, there's also this rise of the idea of Afrofuturism, kind of a science fiction element. Science fiction and fantasy are stereotypically seen as catering to a white audience. The reality has been there have been Black authors and creators for decades and decades in both those fields. But do you see a new interest, a new acceptance of the idea that, hey, fantasy and science fiction, there can be a Black audience for those genres, too?
Oh, absolutely. I'm obviously a Black nerd. And, you know, I like those genres as well. And I enjoy Black Panther. And yeah, I think people really underestimate, or rather Hollywood, or you could say, or whoever has the big money who's producing TV shows or anything. You know, I think there's a tendency to underestimate how the diversity of audiences, even within a Black audience, the diversity that's there. There is no one type of Black movie or Black TV show, and they can cross genres, and there will be audiences for it.
We'll leave it there for now. Maya, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Maya Phillips, a freelance arts and entertainment writer. We were talking about the new Black surrealism, an art form that's showing up in movies and TV shows that use satire and absurdity to shine a light on racial issues in the United States. In high school, most of us had to take at least one class on civics, social studies, or American government. Those classes aim to teach us how our government works and get us ready to be engaged citizens after graduation. With the attention youth activists have gotten after school shootings and with digital devices making political news more accessible than ever, is civics education doing its job? In research released last month, our next guest and her colleagues looked at the ways that civics education differs from one state to another and the types of activities students are spending time on. Elizabeth Mann Levesque is a fellow of governance studies in the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, why did you and your colleagues want to dig into what kids are learning in school about civics and their government?
Sure. So we really had two main motivations for this study. So the first motivation was just the divisiveness and discord in our national politics today. So this prompted us to think about, you know, as you said, what is the role that schools can play in teaching students how to participate productively in public debate and in democratic life more generally? The second motivation is with the recently passed Every Student Succeeds Act that was passed in 2015 and that replaces the No Child Left Behind Act. Really, we're in an era now where states have an opportunity to be innovative in terms of thinking about what students should be learning, how do we hold schools accountable, how do we measure student and school performance. So this is really a natural transition point, and it seemed to us like a good time to just think about what are the goals of civics education and to also look at what states are doing to reach those goals.
Before we dig into the details of your findings, let's look at that issue of the goals of civics education. And I'll oversimplify, but it seems like there's two main ideas. One is you learn the basic facts about how a bill becomes a law, checks and balances, branches of government, the fact-based side of things. And on the other hand, there's the idea that you learn how to engage as a citizen, whether that's at the local, state, or national level through sort of practical, applied ways of learning. A, do I have that right? And B, is that kind of something we go back and forth on?
Yeah, so I think that's an excellent summary of the analysis here. So I think this is a really good question. So, you know, to your point, our analysis, which is based on recommendations and other analysis from leaders in the field of civics education, our point is that teaching students knowledge, skills, and dispositions matters. And so, as you described, that means things like, of course, a knowledge-based coursework in civics, discussion of current events, things like that. That's essential. If you don't have that knowledge, then you don't have a good starting point. But from there, teaching students what it means to actually be an engaged citizen, how you make your opinion heard, how you voice your opinion productively, how you engage with others who disagree with you. In terms of dispositions, we think about things like a sense of civic duty, a sense of kind of civic welfare and the welfare of society at large. So these to us are the aspects of really a well-rounded civics education. And I think that there is a lot of support for this approach, in doing this research. As we talk about in the report, we refer to the six proven practices, which embraces this perspective. We talk about the C3 framework, which also has this kind of, holistic approach to civics education. But I wouldn't say that this is, a completely agreed upon approach to civics education. So I think that there are definitely some who argue that the essential focus really should remain on building that knowledge base and that teaching civic engagement isn't necessarily within the scope of the civics curriculum. So I do think that there are some disagreements still there.
When we see national test scores and state test scores, looks like we assess kids a lot on math and a lot on language skills, English, reading, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Regardless of how we do civics education, are we doing enough of it?
So I think that, thinking about that question in the context of, standardized tests and nationwide standardized tests, so we do administer a nationwide standardized test referred to commonly as the NAEP. We administer that test less frequently in civics when we compare that to, for example, math and reading. But that's kind of just one dimension of looking at assessment, because of course there are things that you can get at on a standardized test that may be kind of the knowledge aspect that, but then there are other things that you maybe can't get to as much, which is kind of that skills and disposition. So I think that this actually going forward is a really important question when we think about what should we be doing in the classroom and how do we measure that and what can we capture and not capture in a standardized test. And so I think that kind of going forward, we're going to have to think really carefully about that.
Talking to Elizabeth Mann Levesque from the Brookings Institution, looking at the state of civics education in the United States. Elizabeth, let's dig into what you found when you looked at state requirements for civics education. Broad strokes, what are states requiring? What are most of them not requiring?
Sure. So what we found is that looking nationwide, it's more common that states require components of civics education related to that knowledge piece we were talking about. So, for example, 43 states, that includes Washington, D.C., have at least one required course for high school graduation that is either in civics or related to civics, so, U.S. history or American government. We see that 51 states, so, all states in Washington, D.C., in their standards or curriculum frameworks mention discussing current events. So, great. There's a lot of widespread coverage there. We also see that the majority of states in their standards mention news media literacy. So those, and we of course did not look at all the factors, that contribute to a high quality civics education. But of the ones that we looked at, those were the three where there was really the most coverage. And those all kind of fall in the context of fact building, information transmission, knowledge building, that kind of thing, which, as we mentioned, that's good. That's positive. That's really an important aspect of this type of education. What we saw less of was the more participatory or engagement aspects of civics education. So we saw many fewer states incorporating or mentioning service learning in their standards. We also saw just over half of states, 27 states, mentioning simulations of democratic procedures. So that's like a mock trial or a mock election in their standards. And we also saw just under half of states, 23, have used or are planning to use that C3 framework I mentioned to, you know, update or modify their standards. And again, that's that framework has a number of components, but one of them is kind of focusing on that participatory side. So in general, what we saw is there's quite extensive coverage on that, you know, knowledge-based component, which is good, it's reassuring, but there's less coverage when it comes to that teaching engagement and modeling engagement and giving students an opportunity to, you know, really experience that in a classroom setting.
And I saw, I think it was in your report, a survey of students to say, asking, did you do this particular activity, or how often do you do that? What kind of things did you find there?
Sure. And so this was looking at, exactly, so this is a survey of 12th grade students from 2010, and that was administered by the NAEP. And so exactly, what we found is that students reported that it's much more common that they engage in kind of that knowledge-based or classroom-based activities as compared to more kind of engaged activities. So let me just give you an example there. So for example, 63% of students said that they discuss current events in their civics class at least on a weekly basis. So that's a lot, right? That's the majority. On the other side of that, 70% of students said that they never wrote a letter to give an opinion or help solve a problem. 56% of students said they never took part in role-playing, mock trials, or dramas. And, you know, 31%, they haven't taken part in debates or panel discussion. So I just go through those numbers just to give you a sense that when we think about, you know, and those are students saying they've never done that. And so even something like building a mock trial into a civics course at some point, we're seeing a lot of students just aren't doing this at all, let alone aren't doing it regularly, and that raises some concerns when we think about, you know, if you're not learning what it actually means to engage, to participate in this process, in this classroom setting, for some students, they're not really going to have a lot of opportunities to learn that, and that's going to put you at a disadvantage, you know, when you're trying to make your voice heard, when you're trying to, you know, engage in public debate, make your opinion heard, things like that.
We're talking to Elizabeth Mann Levesque, fellow at the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution. We're looking at civics education in American schools and whether it prepares students to be engaged and active citizens. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a student now or a recent graduate, do you feel like your civics class is preparing you to be engaged in public life after graduation? Did you do some of those things, not just the book learning, but the actual, you know, mock trials or mock elections, things that might prepare you to actually engage in the world of civics, of local politics, national politics? If you work in education, if you're a civics teacher yourself, love to hear from you and what you think about the curriculum you're working with and the kind of projects you do with your students. And for anybody, what is important for a student to know, to learn, to do by the time they graduate high school when it comes to civics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Elizabeth Mann Levesque is with us from the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution, sharing recent research on the state of civics education in American schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Did what you learned about civics in school set you up to be engaged in your community or in politics? Do schools need to change with the times? If you're in school now or a recent grad, what do you think about the civics classes or American government classes you took? Did you do some of this hands-on kind of stuff, writing letters on an issue, mock trials, mock elections, that kind of thing? If you work in the schools, love to hear from you as well. If you're a teacher or an administrator, what is the state of civics education in your classroom? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Elizabeth, we heard from Andrew on Facebook. He says he doesn't think he was taught how to register to vote back in school. Is that kind of the basic sort of thing that we want students coming out knowing how to do?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that that's a great example of one of the skills that we would think about when we're talking about knowledge, skills, and dispositions. You know, so that kind of comes back to this earlier point I raised, which is learning how to do something like registering to vote. That is a key entry point to making your voice heard and participating in the political process. So, yeah, I mean, that absolutely is in the category of what we're talking about.
Can you talk about the value of, instead of reading about, say, how a trial works, doing a mock trial, or instead of reading about, you know, how to contact your congressperson, actually writing that letter? Why is that hands-on activity so important?
Sure. Well, I think that there are a couple of really valuable aspects of that. One is just, you know, the how-to aspect, right? And so something like, you know, writing a letter to Congress, that may seem daunting. It may seem, you know, for a student, like, well, I don't, you know, that doesn't apply to me, right? That's for important people, or that's for people who, you know, are experts in this or have something to say. And so, you know, having your students write a letter to a member of Congress, for example, or a local representative, I think part of that is it shows them, no, this includes me, right? My voice matters, and I actually know how to express it now. I also think that there's an aspect of that, you know, let's say you're writing in and you're writing in to express opposition to a member of Congress. That's an excellent teaching opportunity to help students craft a message and learn to communicate in a way that is civil, that uses evidence, that makes their point clear, while respectfully disagreeing with someone. And, you know, that's another important skill, and you kind of get the added bonus of teaching that in this real-world context where it may kind of stick a little bit more with students rather than in a purely classroom setting.
Is there something different about civics education in 2018 in the age of social media than it might have been, say, 30 years ago?
Sure. So I think that, you know, one of these practices that we measure was news media literacy, and that's always been important. It's always been important to be able to understand the source of your news and different perspectives and things like that. But I think especially, you know, of course, the 2016 election is a great case in point, being able to distinguish between real news and fake news and being able to detect bias, whether that's on the left or on the right. You know, I think being able to do that on kind of, you know, mainstream media, but also in social media, I think that's only going to become increasingly important. And, you know, that's one of those real life skills that also I think could be incorporated into a classroom environment or a curriculum. You know, it could be a good way to kind of reach students in the sense that you're engaging with, you know, what they actually see on their phones every day, so it might ring true a bit. And at the same time, you're giving them really important skills to understand, you know, what's happening in the world around them and how to interpret that accurately.
Let's bring in our callers now. Peter is with us in Green Bay. Peter, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Peter?
I was just thinking back of my high school civics courses and how great they were. The first week or so of class, the teacher, she made us fill out what side of various issues that we were on. And you always had to debate or discuss them from the opposite perspective. You could never bring you always had to argue the other side of it. And it was so funny because they always talk about how, you know, teaching on one way or the other. And I always wondered what side of the political spectrum she was on, because I could never figure it out. And I was very politically engaged.
Peter, thanks a lot for the call. We're kind of losing your connection there. Elizabeth, this idea of making people argue from different sides or maybe from a side they disagree with as part of their civics education.
Yeah, you know, I think that, again, that's one of those skills that will be emphasized. So, you know, what the caller mentioned is a great example of how you do that. So you think about something from someone else's perspective. You think about how to gather evidence and facts to support and evaluate multiple sides of an issue. You learn to listen, you know, and maybe think about things differently than you did before. I realize that what I'm describing just kind of sounds like good listening skills and, you know, skills that can serve people well in all aspects of their life. And I think that's true, but I think that's particularly true in the context of civic engagement and participation. So, yeah, that's an excellent example of the kind of skill that we think is important to incorporate in, you know, regular classroom learning.
Peter, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about civics education in schools with Elizabeth Mann Levesque with the Brookings Institution, co-author of some recent research on that topic. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Eau Claire. Jim, hi.
Hi. Thanks for this radio presentation. Yes, I was school superintendent back in Adrian, Michigan. Way back in 1986, we approached a judge regarding having students serve as jurors, and he did. So he set up a program where our students along with all the students from the county, were served as jurors for any trial of individuals in the teens, 19 on down, and they were legal jurors in court, and so they had trials. I still have a photograph of one of those trials in one of my areas, and also the only thing they couldn't do was a student was not selected if they were involved with another student from their school. That was one thing that the judge did not want. But they served as jurors.
Wow.
And every single student that graduated from high school at 18 was registered to vote.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Adrian, Michigan, one of my cousins, might have been in one of those programs with you. Thanks for that. So this idea, wow, actually having students as jurors, Elizabeth.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, one point that I kind of picked up on that made me think of something that I think is important and really relevant is that, you know, I think that's, you know, what that teacher was, you know, working towards possibly. And one kind of bigger point is that our students, you know, I've been talking about this in terms of what benefits our students, what do they need to know. But, you know, that's a case in point where our students are also members of our society. And once they turn 18, they're, you know, potentially voting members. And they're, in a lot of ways, they're the future of our democracy. And so they are going to be the people who are serving on juries. They are going to be the people who are judges and lawyers and politicians and everything else. And so, you know, thinking about how do we give, you know, all students kind of equal access to be able to know how to fill those roles and to see themselves in those roles and, you know, playing that part in our democracy, you know, I think is really important.
Jim, thanks for the call. Mike is with us now in Green Bay. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks. So I guess I'm going to be devil's advocate a little bit here. I think civic engagement is largely a democratic notion, I think, and I'm curious how, you know, there seems to be a growing influence of money in politics as far as, you know, lobbyists and large corporations and all that kind of stuff influencing that
Mike, I'm going to jump in because we're just about out of time, but Elizabeth, should civics education look at the role of money and lobbying in politics?
I mean, I think the exact kind of civics education we're talking about, you know, where it's well-balanced, is exactly what's needed to give students the skills to look at those kinds of questions, you know. So certainly teaching from, you know, one perspective or another is not the goal, but helping students understand that, yes, this is a question we should be asking, and this is something you should be evaluating when you're looking at, you know, support for different policies or where our policies come from.
Mike, thanks for the call. Briefly, as we wrap up, Elizabeth, are you hopeful that people will take the results of your study and make civics education better from state to state?
You know, I think that there's a lot of excellent work happening in schools and in states, and I think there are a lot of good resources out there that we talk about in this report that can help, you know, states and then on down from there to the local level, you know, modify and adapt and bring in some of these, you know, this well-rounded approach to civics education. So, yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of good work happening, and I hope that it continues.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Elizabeth Mann-Levesque is a fellow of governance studies in the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution. We've been looking at a report on the state of civics education in the United States and whether or not it's preparing kids to be engaged citizens after graduation. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your stories, maybe your experiences in civics class as a student, maybe as a teacher. You can do that on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Was there a project, like we heard from one caller, that juror project, for example, that really made you think, that really taught you something about the way our civics worked in the United States? Again, share your thoughts and your stories. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I don't want to make anybody feel old, but Mick Jagger was born on this day in 1943, making him 75 years old today. To mark the occasion right now, let us know your favorite Rolling Stones song of all time, if you have one. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, that's at Central Time WPR, or email ideas@WPR.org. Now, Rolling Stone, the magazine, not Rolling Stones, the band, they ranked the top 100 Rolling Stones songs a few years back. We'll count down here from number five. Number five, You Can't Always Get What You Want. Number four, Street Fighting Man. Number three, Sympathy for the Devil. Number two, a lot of people might put this number one, Satisfaction, parentheses, I can't get, no, end parentheses. And their number one was Gimme Shelter. So do you have a favorite Rolling Stones song? Celebrate Mick Jagger's birthday. Let us know what it is. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Yeah.